Welcome to the Economics Explained podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. Today we're going to be reviewing some of the recent episodes on the coronavirus. We'll go back over what we've covered and talk about the issues that are raised and see if there's anything else we can add and whether we agree with some of the points that have been made. To do this, I've invited my good friend, a Brisbane-based businessman, Tim Hughes from Urban Ergo, back onto the program. Tim, great to have you here.
Gene, great to be back here.
Excellent. Tim, I know that from time to time you listen to this podcast and you've appeared on the program before. You were on our episodes on money on the screen, and also we talked about global population, and today I want to talk about coronavirus. So, what else is there to chat about at the moment?
So many things, Gene. Interesting times, mate, and always happy to have a chat.
Absolutely. And the big question now is, particularly in Australia where we seem to have got control of coronavirus, is just how quickly we can get back to normal. And I saw this morning that our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has indicated that he wants to see everyone back at work by July. Now, that's a bit longer than people would probably hope, but I guess they've got reasons for that. So the first thing I want to talk about is just all the uncertainty around coronavirus and its impacts and just how quickly we can get back to normal. And to begin with, I want to play an excerpt from last week's episode with John Kay, who's a fellow at Oxford, well-known British economist. So we'll start off by playing an excerpt from that episode and what John said, and we might reflect upon that.
Now, for coronavirus, we need to ask what is going on here. And we need to understand what is going on here rather better than we do. Now, we can build quite good epidemiological models. What we don't know in these models is the values of the key parameters. And the two key parameters actually are, if someone has the virus, how many people do they pass it on to? And if someone contracts the virus, what is the likelihood that they will die or become seriously ill as a result? Now, we still don't know, even roughly, what these parameters are. And we don't know much about what the incidence of infection is in the underlying population. Now, interestingly, just in the last couple of days, we have plans in the UK to do some random testing over the next year of people to try and establish what these parameters actually are. And if you do that random testing, combined with a kind of contact tracing that was done in Singapore and Korea, then you can get a pretty good picture of what is going on here. The interesting thing is that the costs of obtaining additional information are pretty small relative to the costs of making policy on the basis of poor information. That's why asking what is going on here is so important, and understanding it key to determining sensible policies.
Okay. One of the things I've been reflecting on is, how do we make decisions in this environment where we really don't know a lot about the key parameters and whether this might come back in a second wave? Have you been thinking about that, Tim? Do you have any thoughts on that and what John Kay said there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I'm a layman with this, so I'm just speaking from my own perspective, and I think undoubtedly the best advice that's come through from this is, yeah, to listen to the scientists, listen to the experts. Some of the leaders around the world have just been speaking from their own opinion, which clearly isn't a great base of knowledge. And I think it was interesting what John Kay was saying there, because it is a case of, like, there are precedents with viruses, but each one seems to have its own personality, its own strains, and so each one needs to be discovered anew, it seems. So there's a lot to find out. And it could take time. Like it seems that a vaccine isn't a simple thing to get for a coronavirus. So we should expect that this will happen or hang around rather for quite some time.
Exactly. And what I find extraordinary is that we don't know exactly what's going to happen with the change of the season. So we know that we get more flu in winter and we get more colds, but scientists aren't completely sure why that's the case. It's possibly related to the fact that these viruses don't survive as well in the warmer weather, so that they prefer the colder weather. It could be because we're indoors more. It could be because we're getting less vitamin D from the sun, but we don't really know. But we presume that will help. So the Northern Hemisphere, so the US and UK, they're going to be going into summer, so that will help reduce coronavirus. But in Australia, we're going the opposite way, so that could be problematic for us, and that might be why we're Scott Morrison is saying we may not get back to work till July. So it's just incredible that this has revealed how little we know about things.
I think the response from Scott Morrison and the government, you know, Josh Frydenberg, has been pretty good. Once they got on board, I think they've really ticked a lot of boxes. You know, they've put a lot of support out there, financial and otherwise. And even though it might be, you know, it's never going to be perfect. You're never going to please everybody. But certainly from the figures, because that's all that matters, is like, you know, the new cases and the, you know, the transmission rate, that's certainly come down. And so far, job well done. But in many ways, I think that seemed to be fairly straightforward. I think the next steps aren't necessarily as straightforward. And the only thing that can happen, we can expect the numbers obviously to go up with the restrictions getting eased. So no one's, like John Kay was saying, you know, there's so much to be learned about all of this. And it's interesting, like we could end up just like an accordion sort of expanding and contracting for the rest of the year or until a vaccine is discovered. Or it sounds like it may be more likely that there is a good treatment that can come out before a vaccine, and so that may be something that would allow restrictions to be eased. You know, if it could be treated better, that might eventuate before a vaccine.
Yeah, let's hope that you know, we can get either a vaccine or a treatment like that. One of the things we were chatting about earlier today before the recording was the fact that we have to do this incrementally, don't we? So we talked about how we're going to be sending children back to school, and then we've got to allow time to see how that goes and whether there's a spike in cases. So it's going to be baby steps all the way, isn't it? Just be incremental.
Yeah, and I get it. Like, you know, this sort of a strong feeling to try and get back, you know, kids back to school, everyone back to work. Obviously, it makes sense. And the idea that the kids don't transmit it, I think, is being overlooked a little bit. I think clearly there will be transmissions, but hopefully we're at a point now where we can get on top of that a lot quicker. Like I think in the initial stages, we were caught on the hop a little bit, and that was harder. So having contained that, with the restrictions being eased, hopefully then regionally, and you know, if there's an outbreak at a school or whatever, that can be closed down locally rather than closing down a whole state or territory.
Yep. I think the issue with school children, so my understanding of the evidence is that they can certainly transmit it, but they're less likely to suffer from it, so that you could have all of these asymptomatic school children who are transmitting the coronavirus but aren't actually suffering from it. So they can definitely transmit it, and then if they go and see grandma or grandpa, then they could pass it on to them, and bad results. So yeah,
it's a difficult one, because I mean there's every population has at-risk people, and there are at-risk kids who absolutely more than anybody need to be protected from this. And so you know, schools are still a risk. And there were things like, and I haven't heard it mentioned yet, but like, for instance, in Singapore, it seemed to be a done thing where kids had their temperature taken at the start of the day. And I would have thought that that would have been a good measure to maybe bring in. We've had the time to sort of maybe put that in place for when we bring the kids back. But I haven't heard that mentioned. And I thought that was an opportunity. You know, it can still be done. But that kind of thing, I thought, would be a good idea. Because I know my wife's a primary school teacher, and sick kids do get sent to school. It's just that, you know, everybody's done it at some point, and that will undoubtedly happen at some time. But if that was picked up by a thermometer in a first thing in the morning, then that is, in my book, you know, probably a good thing to add to the way we ease these restrictions.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess the challenge is you may not be picking up those asymptomatic children, but at least you'd be picking up the ones that are showing signs.
That's so, right. I mean, I guess that's what John Kay's talking about. Like, you know, there's all these different things that you know, the more data you get, the longer it goes, the more data you get, the better idea you have about the traits and personality of the particular virus.
Okay. Well, let's talk about reopening the economy. We've had massive economic disruption caused by coronavirus. Over 30 million additional unemployed people in the US, nearly a million additional in Australia, I think, on some of the estimates I've seen. We're going to have double digit unemployment rates. It's a massive economic hit. We're going to have businesses that will never reopen. And there's been this discussion about, well, have we made the right decision here? And we see a country such as Sweden where people are still out at cafes and restaurants and enjoying themselves, and they haven't reacted as other countries have. Now, they've had much higher death rates than everywhere else, but they've made a different decision. I'm going to play a clip from my interview with Dan Mitchell. Dan was a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's the founder of the Center for Freedom and Prosperity. He's a well-known commentator in the US. And I'll play what Dan said in the interview that I conducted with Dan a few weeks ago, and I'll be interested in your thoughts on that.
In the United States, every time Trump says something about we want to reopen the economy, you have some people demagoguing, saying, oh, he's putting a price tag on human life. Well, the reality is everyone puts a price tag on human life. Anytime any of us get into an automobile, we're taking a tiny, tiny chance that we might be in a car wreck and die. Anytime any of us have gotten on an airplane in our lives, we're taking a tiny, tiny chance that we could die. So we make cost-benefit decisions all the time. Here's a great example. There are, in the United States, about 30,000 highway fatalities a year, car accidents, things like that. Well, if we had a national 5-mile-per-hour speed limit, presumably we wouldn't have any traffic deaths. But we don't do that because we know it doesn't make sense from a cost-benefit basis. So all throughout our legal system, throughout our regulatory system, throughout scientific analysis, it's very well understood by every single scholar that, yes, of course, we put a price tag on human life all the time. And obviously, if we keep our economy shut down forever, there'll be a tremendous cataclysmic negative effect on the well-being of people. As a matter of fact, the United Nations just put out a report that the economic damage from the coronavirus could wind up killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of children, primarily, of course, in very poor countries, because they understand, even the United Nations, which doesn't really have a lot of economic common sense, but even they understand that if you weaken an economy, you are having a negative effect on the health and well-being and the longevity of a population. So, you know, I certainly don't want to embrace every silly thing Donald Trump says, but I think he's right that, yes, of course, it's in our interest, and not only in terms of GDP, but it's also in the interest in terms of just the health and well-being of the population to begin to have some economic production again. Because sooner or later, if we have no economic production, we're going to run out of money that the government can borrow and give us. People have to produce in order for us to have things to buy.
Okay, Tim, any thoughts on what Dan had to say there?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, like, because, you know, it's a good point, but it's really hard to imagine sort of making that decision that could overload the health, well, would overload the health system, put, you know, the frontline medical doctors and nurses at a tremendous risk, and their families and everything. So to make that conscious decision to say, I mean, yeah, it's a difficult one. I guess also there comes a point where countries can't afford to lock down any longer. I mean, I guess this is a question for you. Like, at what point does the health crisis overtake the economic crisis, or vice versa? You know, is there a tipping point at which it would say, you know what? Because I know this has been said early on, and I don't think there's a good debate there that needs to be had for sure. But unfortunately, it's come out in, you know, the way that Donald Trump's put it over, for instance, is a little bit polarizing, you know, because he also then goes on to say about drinking bleach and silly things like this, you know. So, but there is a, you know, we're in a very lucky position in Australia. Like, the government has made these funds available, etc., and we can do it for a time, but I don't know how long for. And certainly other countries like Spain are in a far worse position, where they're maybe being forced into a position where they have had to overload the health system.
Yes. I mean, this is the first time we're really being confronted with this question on such a large scale, and I think we're learning. I don't think we know the answer, what the right approach is, whether what Sweden has done has been the best approach. I think we'll get a lot of data out of what's happened, and we'll be able to make an assessment after that. In my view, I don't think our government, I don't think the UK government or US governments could really have not shut down. I don't think, or to have locked down partly, given the risks of overloading the health system, given the fact it could just get out of control, the exponential nature of the growth. I don't think there was really any other alternative. If I were a politician, I certainly probably would have done the same things. Yes, yes.
I think it's interesting because ethically and morally, it has to be shut down. There's no two ways about it. And I can only imagine that after this, that countries will be a lot better at doing that. So whatever needs to be done to deal with this pandemic, I would imagine would be made, some serious changes would be made to be able to deal with another pandemic, so that whatever that lockdown might look like, that it can happen less painfully and quicker, because obviously the quicker it happens, the more successful it is, which we've seen here in Australia. Like, we locked down, 7 to 10 days later, it would have been very different here, which I think has been seen in the UK. I understand they were 2 weeks behind Italy, and that was their window to be able to do something. And of course, the exponential growth of the virus is so quick that that's all it takes, is those few extra days. But I would imagine from this, whatever happens, the upshot should be, or would be, you would hope, that we'd be far better at dealing with another pandemic. You know, there's every chance that it would happen again, and that we'd be able to deal with that locally rather than depending on tests coming from overseas, and, you know, the different things that need to be done, the PPE being, made available more quickly, or even being made here. I think local production around the world would make a lot more sense, as much as possible, following this pandemic.
Absolutely. I think what we'll do next time is we'll pay very close attention if we hear about a new virus in China, and we'll start making policy decisions then and restricting travel as soon as we can. I think we did move quickly in this country, and that in Australia, and that's been that's helped us out a lot. And you're right, if we'd delayed it even a week or 2 weeks, things could be a lot different. So great point. Okay. Let's have a chat about this idea of coronavirus immunity and these immunity passports. Have you heard about that concept, Tim?
I've heard about it, yeah.
Yeah. I'll play a clip from my discussion with Professor Benno Torgler. So Benno is a professor at the Queensland University of Technology, so QUT, down at Gardens Point here in Brisbane. And he's written a really interesting paper on this coronavirus immunity idea. And I'll play the clip. Now, it's not Benno, it's me summarising Benno's paper I read from his abstract, which I thought really crystallised it. I think it's a great abstract, so we'll listen to that. So the abstract begins, "A pandemic is not only a biological event and a public health disaster, but it also generates impacts that are worth understanding from a societal, historical and cultural perspective. In this contribution, we argue that as the disease spreads, we are able to harness a valuable key resource, namely, people who have immunity to corona. This vital resource must be employed effectively, it must be certified, it must be searched for, must be found, and it may even be actively produced. We discuss why this needs to be done and how this can be achieved. Our arguments not only apply to the current pandemic, but also to any future rapidly spreading infectious disease epidemics." Okay, so what Benno is saying is that we've got to find the people who are immune to coronavirus, or they've had it, and you might think that they have some level of immunity. Now, I think the World Health Organization has questioned whether that's the case recently. We just don't know. This is this radical uncertainty John Kay has talked about. We don't really know if you are immune from getting this coronavirus in the future if you have it. So this idea, maybe it isn't such a great idea because we just can't be sure. I think what Benno is saying is that if we can identify people and give them a certificate or a bracelet, then they can live a normal life and we can get them back into the economy. Do you have any thoughts on that, Tim? Any reactions to that idea?
Well, I remember we talked about this in the early days, thinking that if that was the case, that somebody did contract the virus and they got through it okay and then became immune to it, that they in some way would be some kind of superhuman. You know, they can go out and be on the front line, you know, so they could be the first people to be in contact with people who had and be able to treat or help the medical staff treat people and hopefully take some of the risk away from the medical front line. But going back to, again, what John Kay was saying, it seems that you can look at that retrospectively with different viruses and say, yes, in most cases, once you've had it, you have a certain amount of immunity to it, or you are immune to it, to getting it again. But you can't be certain of that when there's a new virus. And so this seems to be the thread here. I know from South Korea, just a week or two ago, it was reported that people were getting it for the second time. But then I think that report then got maybe that, you know, it was thought that that report wasn't as accurate as initially thought, etc. So all these sort of things happen in real time, and no one can be absolutely certain. But if it gets to a point where, yes, there is an immunity to a virus, I think it makes sense to allow people voluntarily to put themselves in a different position where they might be on the front line, for instance, and taking some of the risk away from the current front line.
Okay. We might talk about how we're paying for the response to coronavirus and also making up for all of the lost revenue of governments. And I chatted with my old friend and former Treasury colleague, Joe Brannigan, about this a few weeks ago. And Joe and I had a discussion about how governments borrow money by selling bonds, and also that to an extent there will be money printing to help finance this. And this is something we've talked about in the past,
yeah,
isn't it?
I know where you're going with this, Gene, yeah.
Okay. So let me just replay an excerpt of my conversation with Joe and we'll reflect upon that. Now, what we've seen is occurring in the UK. The Treasury has directed the Bank of England to finance its spending directly. So there's direct monetization. So essentially what's happening is that, as far as I can tell, is that the Bank of England will just provide an overdraft to the Treasury, so it doesn't have to worry about whether it's got the cash in its bank account or not. So this is monetization. This is this modern monetary theory. You could sort of rationalize it in terms of that. I don't know if you've come across that idea, Joe. Have you heard of that concept, the modern monetary theory?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds pretty scary. I mean, for a kind of a traditional economist, but I think that I think the issue is whether the economy is at full employment or not. So, what's the demand in the economy? And if you have something like the coronavirus pandemic, which has forced a shutdown of 30% of the economy, well, that's a greater decline in economic activity than what we probably saw in the Great Depression. And so if the demand in the economy has collapsed by so much, then the downside risks of monetizing the deficit, you know, printing money, seem quite low. It's only when the economy is at full employment, that when you're pumping money into a fully employed economy, that you're just simply driving up prices. And, I think, as we've discussed in the past, we always need to remember what Milton Friedman said about the long-run relationship between the quantity of money and inflation. So, you know, I guess modern monetary theory, or whatever you want to call it, maybe gets a leave pass or a hall pass, in through the middle of 2020, but you wouldn't be recommending it in terms of prudent fiscal and monetary policy in normal times.
Okay, Tim, any thoughts on that? Did that make sense, what Joe and I were talking about?
Yeah, the theory of it makes sense, but I still don't get it. so this conversation started many years ago when Pauline Hanson, one of the local MPs in Australia, at one point suggested, why don't we just print more money, you know, like, and of course, it doesn't make sense, and it can't work. But I'd have to put my hand up and say, I wouldn't know how to explain that. So Gene, please explain.
Okay. We might have to devote a full episode to this one, Tim. But essentially, what's going on is that when the government turns on the printing press to pay the bills, usually it does that when it has a shortage of money for some reason. So it's just spending too much. It's got very heavy needs and very heavy expenditure needs, or it might have big debts to repay. And so that's taking a lot out of the budget. So if you look at the Weimar Republic, so you look at what happened in 1920s in Germany, and they had big debts to the victors in World War One. And what ended up happening is that they turned on the printing press to finance their expenditure. And so you've got the economy out there and the government's paying its bills with newly created money. Now, when it adds new money to the system, because there's more of it, the money's less scarce, it's worth less. So that it's devaluing the currency. If there's a certain amount of economic activity that is occurring because of this money, that the money is facilitating, then if there's more money for the same level of economic activity, then the prices must rise. They must be bid up. So that's essentially what happens. The government's coming out. It's paying all of this, all of these people with newly created money, there are more, well, in Germany, I think there are Reichsmarks. There are more notes out there in circulation, or there's more money in people's bank accounts. But there's only so many goods and services that can be bought, and so the prices get bid up. And so that's essentially what happens. There's a famous equation in economics called the quantity theory of money, which relates the amount of money, M. So M times V, the velocity of money, equals P, the price level, times Y, which is the output of your economy. And so we know that that holds in the long run. And so we know that if governments add to the money supply and the stock of money out there keeps growing and growing, that should end up being reflected in rising prices and inflation. And we know that that happens because we've seen it in the Weimar Republic, and we've seen it in Latin American countries and Zimbabwe, for example. So this is where you get that hyperinflation.
So if, for instance, if you in the obviously it didn't work, but I'm just trying to get my head around it. So the Weimar Republic, if they printed all load of new money and paid off debt with it, like to foreign countries, locally there'd be the same amount of money in circulation. So, I mean, clearly it couldn't work, but I don't understand how that wouldn't work, because it's not necessarily in their own economy. If you paid off foreign debt with it, for instance.
Oh, the problem was, I think they were having to pay in foreign currency. So, yeah, that's a good question about the Weimar Republic, how they actually paid for those debts. But they would have to pay back France in francs and the UK in pounds. But it's still coming out of their budget. So they would have to buy the foreign exchange. I'll have to look up the exact history. I know the basics, but it's a good question you've raised. We'll have to come back to this one. But essentially that government would had to have printed money to help it meet its other expenses, and so that's going to be bidding up prices in the local economy.
I mean, the whole financial system is a bit of a house of cards, it seems. As you know, we saw in the GFC, it's a lot of promises and to pay the bearer of such and such, and bonds and all this kind of thing. So a lot of it isn't real, it appears, which I guess adds to the confusion.
Yes, it's a different. It plays by its own rules, and yes, you can get some pretty wacky outcomes in financial markets. That's right. We might return to this in another episode, because it's clearly of great interest, and I'd like to know a bit more about what happened in the Weimar Republic. And you asked a good question there, and I want to make sure I get the best answer I can for it. So is it okay if I take that one on notice, Tim, and we come back to it in the future?
Absolutely fine, mate.
Okay, good stuff. Okay, now to end the episode, I want to chat about government bailouts. So we've seen all of these companies being placed under great pressure due to the economic damage from coronavirus, and we've seen governments providing various bailouts for companies around the world. In the US, in Australia, we've got this JobKeeper package, which is helping out a lot of businesses by subsidising the wages. But the government's actually resisted bailing out a company directly, so bailing out Virgin Airlines, for example. Whereas in the US, from what I can tell, is the government's been more likely to bail out particular companies. Now, the concern with bailouts, of course, is that you could end up in a situation where there's this moral hazard. These companies start to expect that they will be bailed out by governments if they get into trouble, and therefore they don't save up enough. they don't have the reserves in cash that they need to deal with the bad times. And if you look at what the executives of a lot of these companies are being paid, you'd be thinking, well, you're being paid so much, you should be looking at, you know, what could go wrong and making sure your company's in the right state to be able to deal with these things. If you look at shareholders who've received dividends over the years and they've had appreciating shares, well, one of the reasons for that is that owning shares is risky and that therefore when bad times come, you should suffer. So there's that argument. I think Dan Mitchell, again, so Dan and I spoke about bailouts, he had a really interesting view on bailouts. I thought he would just be totally against them, but it turns out he's not totally against them in this instance because he says that what's gone on is that essentially the government's shut down the economy. You could argue that it's what he calls a regulatory taking, and so therefore there can be some justification for a bailout, but we've got to make sure that it doesn't have a long-run impact. So for our final clip, I want to play an excerpt of my discussion with Dan Mitchell, and we'll reflect on that.
Government is doing a bunch of bailouts. They are throwing trillions of dollars around in the United States, and I wouldn't be surprised if we have a couple of trillion dollars more before this is all over and done with. As far as I'm concerned, the number one thing to focus on is to make sure there's no permanent expansion in the footprint of government in the economy. Okay, fine. We're going to bail out big companies. We're going to bail out small businesses, but just make it a one-time cash infusion. Make sure that once the economy is trending back to normal, that then we have companies allowed to thrive or fail based on whether or not they're satisfying the needs and interests of consumers. And in terms of the airline industry, you know, that's a special case, of course, because 95% plus of their revenue has collapsed overnight. Now, in theory, you could say, well, the assets of airlines are their airliners and also their gate assignments at airports. Well, those things don't disappear if they go into a orderly bankruptcy. So why not just let them go bankrupt as opposed to giving them a bunch of money? Well, the reason politicians are giving them a bunch of money rather than forcing them into a traditional bankruptcy is because they want to make sure the tens and tens of thousands of employees who work at the airlines are kept on the job, or that they're continuing to get pay. And a lot of what is happening in terms of you know, how official Washington, the national government, is reacting in the U.S., it is basically designed to make sure that if you had a job, say, back on January 15th, before this became a big issue, we're going to make sure that you still have a job today. And if necessary, the government's going to subsidize you or subsidize your company in order to keep you on the payroll. And a lot of other countries around the world have done something similar. So it does seem to be the standard operating procedure.
Okay. Any thoughts on what Dan Mitchell was saying there, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult situation for sure. And you can understand the government wanting to support businesses that employ a lot of people. You know, like it's a lot, you know, if those, a lot of companies, if they were to go bankrupt and thousands of people lose their jobs, which of course has already happened, but if they can minimize that, then on the flip side of all of this, then there are fewer people to have to, you know, find new work. And in the instance of airlines, for instance, I mean, it's an interesting one because who knows when the borders are going to open up, you know, sufficiently for them to flourish anyway. It could be a couple of years, who knows, you know, but I mean, I'm just guessing. But it's that thing, like without a vaccine, there's going to be some level of restriction, you would have thought, until that happens or until, you know, there's a successful treatment that comes along.
Yep. I think the best we can hope for in Australia is that we get the interstate travel back in a couple of months. I think Alan Joyce might, the CEO of Qantas, might be planning for July or August, if I remember correctly from the interview. And then there's also this great idea that's been floated of a bubble comprising Australia and New Zealand. Have you heard about that? That's an interesting idea.
I have, and like, you know, as a consumer, as someone, you know, the opportunity to go to New Zealand would be great. But certainly it would make sense if, because of the proximity to each other. There's not a great deal of difference. I wouldn't in any way call New Zealand another Australian state, don't get me wrong, but like it's that thing of there's pretty much Tasmania. It's that geographically they're, you know, we're Anzacs, you know. So as they have the same infection rate or, you know, is similar, it makes a lot of sense to open that up. But of course, you know, the more things open up, the higher the risk of transmission.
Exactly. Just on New Zealand, not being a state of Australia, back in the 1890s, New Zealand attended some of the conventions in the lead up to Federation here in Australia, but it missed the crucial one. So there was the idea that New Zealand could become a state of Australia, but in the end it opted out. Whether that was for the best I think that's an historical, that's an important historical question. But yeah, there's no doubt that there are those strong linkages between Australia and New Zealand. I think about 15% of their population lives in Australia or something, some ridiculous number like that.
I mean, I know there's a great rivalry. I mean, I'm, as you know, I'm from England, so like I just watch the rivalry from the sidelines. But it's a beautiful country. I've got a lot of good Kiwi friends. A lot of friends that I know from England who live in New Zealand, and yeah, I've got a lot of respect and appreciation for that country, and so it certainly makes sense. There's a lot of similarities, and so it makes sense to open up. But as you know, it May the 6th, 2020. Now, it seems that is a little while off yet.
Absolutely, yes, I agree. Okay, so just finally, that point Dan made about not wanting a permanent expansion of government, so that comes from Dan's view that, and his view is based on evidence, that economies tend to grow at higher rates with smaller tax burdens, with smaller levels of government, and he's a libertarian, so he has a he prefers a system. He thinks a system runs better with less government, with more individual responsibility. So he's concerned about that long-run growth of government. But what we could see out of coronavirus is a permanent expansion of government, or citizens accepting more government intrusion in their lives. So, for example, in Australia, we've got this COVID Safe app, and it's something that I've downloaded and millions of other Australians have downloaded, and essentially the government's going to be keeping tabs on who we're coming within 1.5 metres of based on our mobile phones doing this handshake over Bluetooth. It's quite incredible. I never thought I'd see something like that. So there's this bigger question of what this all means for the role of government in the economy and the what it means for individual liberty. Is that something you've been thinking about, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, as far as you know, governance goes, and I'm all for things being simpler. You know, I think there are certainly cases where life's way too complicated, and anything that can simplify that, you know, for instance, with tax and all that kind of thing, I'm all for it. Simpler the better. With the intrusion, I mean, I get it. Like, it's not something I would normally support at all. But in this circumstance of you know, of way of fighting the virus, I tend to agree that it is, you know, you feel a sense of duty to sort of do it, because if that means that it, you know, it helps save lives and puts fewer people at risk, then absolutely. But I'd be on the other side of it all, I'd be one of the first ones to delete the app as well. And also I'd be concerned of what precedent it sets for what other sort of modes of intrusion, because the technology is becoming more intrusive. There's more known about us. And I think that is absolutely something to be valued, to hold on to your privacy.
Exactly. Well, you'd remember the big debate we had about the Australia card in 1986 here, where we rejected a national identity card. There were lots of, I suppose there were protests with it. There was a lot of criticism of that idea, and the government didn't go ahead with it. It did end up giving us a tax file number, which went half of the way. So in terms of helping it crack down on tax evasion, but we don't have a national identity card still.
This is like so many things. I think one of the biggest areas that can be improved on is the area of debate. Quite often, it's just two opposing ideas shouting at each other. And there are so many really important things that need to be debated well. So that ability, hopefully we can get some political leaders who are willing to listen as well as talking. And I think that willingness to agree with something is really missing. And I think people switch off from debate because it's just people shouting at each other. Whereas, like, it needs to be discussed. You know, they're not straightforward. There's merit in something like an Australia card, but how far it goes. And that's along the lines, from my perspective, of simplifying things. If it means that certain things, like tax, and like I said before, if they were simpler, man, I'm all for that. But as far as privacy goes, yeah, absolutely, that needs to be protected as much as possible. And how that works out, well, there's cleverer people than me that I'll be looking forward to hear debate that whole subject.
Okay, those are great points to end on, Tim. I really like your call for our political leaders to not just engage in that vicious partisan debate, but try to reach a common ground based on evidence. So I think that's a really great.
Yeah, and sorry to interject with that, Gene, because, you know, there are positives that come out of crisis, it seems. And one of that is, I think there's been some bipartisan support of some sensible options and some sensible decisions. And that's, you know, it's a relief. You know, it's like, you know, you don't want to hear your parents fighting all the time. You know, it's nice to hear them get on every now and then. It's like, thank you, because we're all in this household together. You know, we are all in this together, as the saying goes. And it takes like-minded people to navigate a way out of a crisis. And so, yeah, it should be done more often.
Absolutely. That's certainly the case in Australia. I think we've had bipartisanship. I'm not sure whether that's occurred in the US. It possibly hasn't, but we might refrain from commenting on the US not being there. So that's up to US listeners to judge. Tim Hughes from Urban Ergo, I've really appreciated your time and being able to chat with you about coronavirus. You've given me a lot of things to think about and something to come back to you on. We're going to have to deal with that money printing in another episode because there are a lot of issues to get across, and it'd be good to cover some of the historical examples. So if you're up for that in a future conversation, we can do that.
Always up for it, Gene. Always happy.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thanks, Gene. Always a pleasure.
We've reached the end of another Economics Explained episode. So thanks for listening all the way through. If you're enjoying Economics Explained, please tell your family and friends and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or on whatever platform you are listening on. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please get in touch. My email address is gene.tunney@gmail.com. Until next week, goodbye.